It's an incredible honor to be here to receive this award. Larry Levis is a poet who I came to not until 2001, when another poet thrust the book Elegy, the book constructed by Phil Levine, into my hands. It was just such a staggering work. From there, I went backwards. It's a book that I've absorbed in some fundamental and important way, and it's a book I've taught. So to be invited to come down here on this occasion is overwhelming. I'm going to read poems from the Book of Giants and then some new work. I want to say, too, before I start, that learning how this prize is adjudicated, that it includes the participation of the graduate students in the MFA program here, adds a real distinction to the prize. I begin with thanks, and with this poem that opens the book, Bocca della Verità, the mouth of truth, which in this case is an ancient Roman drain cover in the shape of a marble disc and representing a human face. It was believed the open mouth would close on the hand of any perjurer who placed it inside. The disc now hangs on the wall of a church in Rome and is a popular tourist stop. In photo opportunity, people put their hand in the mouth and take their picture. When I saw the mouth of truth on that wall in that church, it said something to me, and this is what I heard it say. Bocca della Verità. See that crack at the corner of my eye? A track running like a tear blown back by an unforgiving wind, gathering force from the mind's black accumulations. It's for you, that crack, those jealousies and false heroics made meaningless in the face of certainties. My face. You see it emerging from the stone, your vain denials, the theatrics of home, the opera for which you've trained your voice, its capriciousness, its talent for carrying opportunity's tune. It's for giving in to anger, the pleasure you feel drawing bristles over a rash for your cheapest satisfactions. When you cut someone off, miss another call, forget yourself. When you hold back from an easy true compliment and jump to take offense, all the smallest murders you commit, when you close the door, turn away, draw shades against the sun, for not quite hearing or remembering, for your thoughtfulness pointing to another's lack, for making the right point at the wrong time, for falling out of touch, touching what would rather be left alone, for leaving well enough alone that calls for your intervention. So the single tear digs its groove, knowing, dispassionate, running from the corner of my eye to the rim of my perfect radius, a medallion, a coin you cannot spend, bank, or wear around your neck. Once a mere drain cover, I've risen up. Your applause is not a factor. My mouth opening for your hand that takes what is not given, that gives when it should grasp and drops what it must carry. Billions served, but it is yours I hunger for. Place it inside and see if I don't return some night to chew it off with incisors hidden from the casual glance into such caverns of insignificance. How you file them so keenly, I can taste it even now. The plum lie inside your pie. This next one came about through the convergence of three kinds of details I happened upon. One is very personal. It was an object that a friend who had gone to India returned with and presented to my son, Gus, when he was just, you know, a few weeks old. And it was an embroidered parrot, and it hung over his changing table. And I was spending a lot of time at that table. That parrot started to speak to me as well. The other thing is that people used to ask me whether my son Gus's name was short for anything, and I would say that it was short for asparagus. The third thing is when I learned that the area in New York around where the Twin Towers fell was being referred to as the Frozen Zone, which to me sounded like a kind of ice cream concession stand in a student union or something like that. You know, let's go down to the Frozen Zone and get a cone. Hanging Mobile. The parrot's eye speaks to the sun. My son coos back on his back on the run. Mosquito in the shade. The night crows green. Who rings the bell where you've never been? Baby Gus, asparagus, tips make a fist to knock back the sun. The parrot's eye grows with the moon. My son sings a bubble in the bubble of his room. Rubies in the griddle, the cake falls down, the knife runs for president, the parrot runs the sun. Baby Gus, asparagus, who rings the bell when you ring the bell? Smoke across the bridge plunders the eyes. The wind speaks back what you recognize. Jimmies rain down the frozen zone. The drops drop green. Who dropped the sun? Trampoline. The kids next door who bought it for their mom on Mother's Day, a joke, play it like palms on a marching drum, a rhythmic coital creak that carries clear across the open yard to call my son like a Barnum top hat bard. He runs out in his socks, my turn, my turn. They haul him up so he might bounce and stamp and lift his legs to learn how little one can weigh up there. The moment when the body peaks and hangs, becoming what the body seeks. Weightlessness and weight. Self launching beyond self. Before the theory, fact. Yet as he flies, he drops down like a leaf the earth tries to give back. He tumbles, caught at last in the canvas sheet. Then feels again through socks the warm concrete. Games for someone. Someone is a peach. Someone is a mouth. The peach runs north. The peach runs south. The mouth is open. Its teeth are sharp. It need not run to taste you on its tongue. The peach is flesh. Its heart is a stone. It shines with spit, like a metal or a bone. Someone is a vine. Someone is a blade. The blade trains the vine to grow its own shade. Inside the shade, someone is a nest. Inside the nest, someone is afraid. Someone is a lock. Someone is a key. Someone is a rhyme for liberty. Someone is a breath. Someone, a balloon. A third one knows a knot, but cannot find their room. The bed. Outside the house, the field stretches out fully, dark and inviting. It opens to the night rain. It rains on the houses. It rains on the boy coming home late after supper's been served. His brother's asleep in his own room. He orbits in sleep the other rooms of the house. The boy hasn't eaten. It feels good to feel empty. He's hungry, but empty. He hears the rain hit the field. He listens for the mother, but he hears nothing. He climbs to his room, the second floor, next to his brother's. The father works late now. Now it is night. Now time for bed. He opens the door and discovers a secret. What is the secret? He doesn't know. He doesn't know. His mother lies there asleep on his bed, laid out in a field. The boy is tired. Why is she there? He touches her shoulder, shakes her gently, and calls her. Her face is relaxed. The shut eyes have grown younger. Her hand curls around nothing, nesting the ghost of an egg. She's tired and spent by the day. She's utterly spent, hair undone, shirt loose. But she's dressed as she was that very morning, as the sun warmed the kitchen and the father walked out. The sunlight was silent. Two white cups rested on the counter, still full of coffee, a lactate skin slowly sealing the surface. The dry toast stiffened. All the colors outside, the morning air rinsed by the light, nourished the boy's hunger to be out in the world. Now his mother dreams of walking out in the world. She walks past her high school and sees her old friends. She sits down to eat at her mother's kitchen table, stretching out fully, blueberries stewed, topped with sour cream. The bowl is too small for so many berries. So much sour cream. The sunlight rains down. It pours into the room. She lowers her head and begins to eat like a cat, her mama's favorite cat. She feels herself petted. She likes it like that. The boy tries to wake her. Why won't she wake up? She shouldn't sleep here. This isn't her bed. He can see the large bed she shares with his father. The sheets would be taut, the bedspread smoothed out, tucked neatly under pillows, white as two eggs. The bed is made in its hunger. It's empty but hungry. In her dream, her legs feel like springs. They're tan, as if made of copper. She could walk forever away from the house to have her adventure. Why is she so tired, so alive, and so still? The mother's not a child to be sleeping in his bed. This is his bed where he dreams of adventure. He is not the parent. Doesn't she know it's his bedtime now? Of course, she must know. His hand on her shoulder looks like a starfish. Her body gathers breath as if greedy for air. Even her shoes wish to rouse her, still on her feet. Time to wake up, he sings in her tune. You have to wake up. The tree outside the window awakens in the rain. The rain is a whisper. The boy has grown up. Time to wake, time to sleep. The mother's in love. This is called Ouija, Coney Island Beach After Midnight. It's in the voice of great photographer, photojournalist Ouija. If you don't know the name, you would recognize the images. Some of the really the great photojournalist images of 20th century America were taken by Ouija. The movie audience with the 3D glasses on, all you see is them, that's Ouija. One of the things Ouija liked to do was take his camera and go out onto the beach, Coney Island at midnight, take pictures of people doing stuff out there. This poem was inspired by a particular image that appears in Ouija's great book, Naked City, which was published in the 40s. It's in his voice, but the poem steals a stanza from Hardy. And I'm not sure how Ouija's voice gets into Hardy, but when I found the stanza by Hardy, I knew that it was the shape of this very American, hard-boiled, urban voice of Ouija's. And it sounds like this. Ouija, Coney Island Beach after midnight. No moon is good. I take off my shoes and go silently so as not to lose the shot I know is lurking there. American made is my stock in trade, as whatever's in the frame I choose, I chose, though it's like I wasn't there. What's out there? Why, sweethearts in love, making love out where it's dark enough. I wouldn't disturb them for the world. Each kiss, what's left between each breath, hard work, but the kind that makes you laugh. There goes a match. What's that I heard? There, in the lifeguard station lookout, lovers exhausting each other's doubt. I'll catch them fast without a flash. To make it clear how they appear like drags inhaling their way to ash, or a mouth getting ready to shout. Too dark to have used the range finder there. It's like scooping yourself. Your feeling, where trying to find the way, you're caught, the frame in which your subjects twitch, alive, exposed, and as if too near. The lens opens, and you take the shot. Why they were up there near the sky, I thought I'd see as the fluid primed the image into a final shape. But all I found was a kind of sound, a woman up there like a lie, alone and bewildered after the rape. You can read the lifeguard only sign she leans against. There's no clear line between her hair and where the night begins to fan out in a plan, expanding further than stars can shine, and outside my frame to make it right. What did she choose? Which choice was deferred as she waited for the bus without a word, no matter where she sat to wait? All that is there, the apparent stare out to the wave that can't be heard, that she readies herself to contemplate. I was living in Rome for a year, and I had a chance to travel around, and one of the places I went to was the ancient site of Herculaneum outside the environs of Naples. And one of the things I found there was a postcard that I liked very much. I purchased it with the intention of sending it to a friend, the poet Tom Gunn, but he died before I could mail it. This poem's called Postcard to Tom. Addressed, it lately sits propped on my desk with no reason now to go. You're gone, somewhere behind the snow screen, though I think you'd laugh at this lucky charm from Herculaneum, suspended by a chain in open doors even the bravest might have fled through. A gladiator, and in both raised fists a knife to strike himself, his own huge leaping cock curving up with a snarling panther's head to savage the source of its awakening. The mind, alarm of want wringing the blood, as appetite grows to feel itself grow longer, twisting back on the hot stone of the heart. And dangling down from panther cock, each foot, the muscled back and swollen scrotal sac. A little bell, provoked by the cooling wind. This one is a kind of companion. It's called Found Letter. In the first line, I address someone else named Josh. Found Letter. What makes for a happier life, Josh, comes to this. Gifts freely given that you never earned. Open affection with your wife and kids. Clear pipes in winter and summer, screens that fit. Few days in court with little consequence. A quiet mind, a strong body. Short hours in the office. Close friends who speak the truth. Good food, cook simply. A memory that's rich enough to build the future with. A bed in which to love, read, dream, and reimagine love. A warm, dry field for laying down and sleep to trim the long night coming. Knowledge of who you are, the wish to be none other. Freedom to forget the time. To know the soul exceeds where it's confined, yet does not seek the terms of its release. Like a child's kite. Catching at the wind that flies because the hand holds tight the line. the hand holding tight the line, you can hear a line about the poetic line too. This next poem is one in which I was seeking to let out the poetic line further than I ever had before. And it's the poem that has Larry Levis's breath in it, not just at the level of the line, but in something of how I discovered its structure as well. I'm thinking of those long unspooling poems in Elegy, the way that he builds a world out of surprising returns, calls and responses. It's called Vida Nuova. It's the poem that David mentioned that takes place in Berkeley, California. Vida Nuova. They called him the polka dot man. So I also picked up the custom. But what did he call himself? This was Berkeley, the early 90s. The movement hadn't completely died, though threatened by tides of cappuccino foam and hair conditioner. There were still protests, of course, communist, animal rights, anti-apartheid, pro-Palestinian rallies, and rallies against the Gulf War. As before, as now. But the merchants wanted Telegraph Avenue, the interface of town and gown, cleaned up. However, not too clean. Property should be safe. Customers should not feel threatened, though a certain amount of general non-standard behavior was good for business, historical, identifying in its own way consumable. The Avenue felt the pressure, social programs giving way to corporate crackdowns as UC executed its plan to retake People's Park by planting flowers and volleyball nets. With their jockstrap arsenal, frat boys would flush out the undesirables. The police would intensify a routine of breaking down the free bins, which people left discarded clothes for the people in the park. People would then rebuild the bins, though that wasn't part of the plan, and the police would tear them down to find them later rebuilt. The situation, as I say, escalated. And people, especially the people in the park, eventually felt called to action as if on a grid of legendary actions where all the moves were known, yet given life in the new patterns unfolding. A woman with a machete and a knife, an anarchist, even broke into the chancellor's mansion with a blowtorch, and a questionable cop shot her in the back and in the heart. This was 1992. People gathered for that one, even some poets, and rioted. But without looting, it was a protest. In People's Park, where she shared food and shelter and fought the university, was renamed after her. But it never stuck. It's still People's Park. The people named it, and custom kept it. Her name was Rosebud Abigail DeNovo. Her parents named her Laura, but she broke that custom, renamed herself, and fled the institution. The cops thought she was crazy. They knew she had a history, or they didn't know. That's why they shot her, or why they didn't not shoot her. Quote, there was no opportunity to utilize the dog. Her friends didn't think so. Why didn't they flush her out with gas? That she was on the edge, though one friend found her eating pieces of glass for breakfast, upset he no longer wished to make bombs. But the best poet, he said, if she had broken into my home with a machete, I'd have shot her too. He knew better than anyone how to make a rhyme sound wholly natural, and he kept the hell away from graduate students. In the end, her excessive force lost to the cops, the confusion of what happened now part of the public record. DeNovo, Rosebud, of the new, soon to flower. In her desperation and despair, her anger, her desire to belong somewhere, her sense of being with others, of belonging to her commitment, her steady Pepsi and candy bar diet, sleep-deprived and constantly harassed by the law, by the street she fled to that led her to the park she fought for, where she lived at the center of a web, the strands of a practical ideal, let people be in the park, dissolving in the heat of her senseless martyrdom, as though a rose should shut and be a bud again. But this isn't a political poem, nor a romantic dream, because the polka dot man paid no attention, as before, as then in 1992. He was a life artist or something, and his name, the name that custom gave him, was not a mystery, nor an allegory, though he wore his origins like a coat of arms, sweatsuits with perfect polka dots painted on them, upper body and lower, polka dots of every color, every size. He was lean, roughly handsome, with a squint like Clint Eastwood, and he wore a sun visor like Clint Eastwood on the golfing green, and sometimes even carried an umbrella open against the sun, its indisputable midday authority. If it rained, he kept the umbrella closed and stayed home, wherever that was. Under the sun, though, he would sometimes sleep in the plaza between Wheeler Hall and Dwinelle, his body laid out in the warmth on the hot stones, with his head cool enough under the umbrella he opened on the ground. Awake, he'd pace the square patterns of the inlaid plaza brickwork, careful to keep on a course of straight lines and 90-degree angles, which he otherwise improvised on the legendary grid. Where to turn, when to continue on the straight path until it was time to turn. So that his work, you could say, was to wear a suit of circles and trace a path of squares. He carried himself erect, his dignified gait crisp, militant even, expressing delineated intention, but visibly open to possibility as well. He had style and something like a subject, a commitment, his mode. Yet one was never quite sure how he would do it, what path he would choose as he chose it, for he did not know himself. That was his pleasure at the center of repose. He was never seen anywhere other than the plaza, at work in the web of his tracings, or asleep. He wouldn't talk to anyone, except girls. But from a distance, he appeared capable of great charm. I could see he possessed what you'd call a winning smile of welcoming white teeth. His program was working, no question. But what was it? This went on for years. In the meantime, I was studying, trying to learn how to write a line and how to make a turn, when to circle back. And all the girls I talked to wore black and understood the paradigm of the political unconscious, and I was getting nowhere. I was reading Robert Duncan to open the chain of rhyme in search of new structures, a new correspondence for ancient responsibilities. But I was like an open sheet in a closed book, a human faculty without sufficient will. At some point, I noticed his polka dots were changing, opening up from the center, as if from a gradually increasing centrifugal force felt within each dot, as if some kind of internal revolution were gaining speed. Each week, a new suit, with a new set of dots opening further, swirling, spiraling, as he edged week by week from the center of Sproul Plaza towards the busy sidewalk, crowded with hungry students forming lines in front of food stalls, circling around themselves, negotiating the crowd they were a part of, as if he, too, were at the center of a world represented by a dot, and by a virtue of some force pulled to the perimeter and yearning beyond it, till the circles undid themselves entirely, becoming sets of lines, some even parallel lines like equal signs between shapes or stories, the present in correspondence with the future he was working out from the center, where he remained isolated and in control, to the margin, where people lived more fully engaged with each other in the customary happiness of eating modestly and joking around, the bright colors and patterns of their clothes all mixing together in the loose weave of the sidewalk. This must be a political poem. Then one day he appeared in a blank suit, white, without dots or swirls or lines, completely erased of its former signs. He seemed tenuous at first, confronting the open sheet of his own being. Then his posture took the shape of interest, enjoyment, as he spent the afternoon mingling in the crowded street bordering the campus. And the next day, he disappeared, as if the rose should pluck herself and float away on the current. No public record of such an act exists. This private integration, a receding into the public campo we call the city, in which he calls himself by the name he's now known, though none of us knew it. We saw him each week on his invented stage. The new life, in flower, having turned with the existential seasons. Until a few months later, I ran into him working downtown at the recycling center. From the outside, looking through the glass door, I caught his eye, and he shot back a look of aloof amusement. It was no big deal. The new life here, returning redemptions to a point of origin. He seemed decked out in a suit of modest defiance. I refuse your refuse. Though he leisurely made for the door. As if I stood in a crowd, waiting to throw it all away, in the right colored bins, my courtesy and patience rendered me absurd, out of line. It was my turn to move, but time moved instead, and I was still standing there when, with a curt nod, he opened the door and said, "Whose permission are you waiting for?" Well, I'm going to end with two new poems. Someone was asking me what it's like to live in Washington, D.C. It's really weird. The occasion of this poem was a kind of exhibition that was hosted in D.C. at the Kennedy Center, an exhibition brought over from Beijing. Kennedy Center. Young boy of the wushu takes his turn in the demo outdoors, tin knives trailing bright scarves that cut clean figures through air, the beat of 10 drums sending him gyroscoping, arms like chopper blades spinning before they lift. So even a boy younger than he appreciates the stern concentration gathering as he prepares legs to kick higher than his head, snapping back to lead the body that way in the counter thrust. 5? 6? A warrior dancer tracing nature of cobra and mongoose in quick calligraphy of cloth. Opposition in flight, complements finding space along a single axis. Beijing in Washington, unfurling a scene between art and war in this bright, chilly memorial plaza running from the Shaolin Temple to the highbrow exchange. Is that David Carradine serenely walking the sill above Rock Creek Parkway? Thus, grasshopper, hold in the mind the life-size terracotta warriors of First Emperor Qin, 2 of 8,000 upstairs encased in glass, ready to meet the enemy on the eternal march to heaven. But it's not heaven. Only 2 levels higher than street that the army copters serving as VP escort angle down the river. Open doors framing the soldiers, goggles and guns looking back to us, eye to eye, calculating the shot between us. Only 1 instant in the new migration. And our house, too, has its new migration, its hero of his story, who wakes from dream and gathers lightsaber, pirate knife, and jeweled rapier to make the journey from mountain peak to peaceful valley, where he lays his weapons at the foot of our bed before burrowing between us, first light thin as a transparent seam between here and there, us and them, while the great metal bird, having heard the call, touches ground behind concrete ramparts that nest permanently now on the busy downtown streets in the inevitable yet already open next theater of operations. On with this one, a little bit lighter in its aperture. It's called Rock Creek. Can two loves play and prime each other without one shining so much brighter it absorbs the weaker one, like brother shadowing brother, lover lover? We watched our boys play in the stream, the older leading from rock to rock, and needing the younger one to seem determined himself to reach the bank. And he did seem so, gripping a hand and shouting, held in place by one he'd never catch with his command, "Wait up, wait up," and "Let's pretend." Two Indians, perhaps, in search of soapstone they'll carve into bowl or pipe, or hunting deer, pheasant, or perch they'll spear and cook under a beech whose leaves are lit to 100 hues. Green, dazzling network, shifting tones, intensities, and casting on my eye a duplicating view. Two boys, us two. And seeing them without us, one of those moments when the weave in time breaks open, I thought I'd fear this intimation, withdraw in silence. For that split in the continuum that raced past the comfort of known limit was a complicating, shadowed grace. What soothing complications, though, varieties of incandescence like shades of understanding how a world is made by touching you. A world is what you say, and not just what you mean to do. Too often you forget, and you stay inside your shell. But there, with you, the poem, still unformed, uncases me to find you where you are, to start again the possibility of rhyming us outside of art. What's that look like? I mean, right now, the conversation moving out past the trespass we allow, defining certainty and doubt. I was listening, or trying to, and trying to make a common sound, a stream of air on which there flew an understanding gaining ground. And there was more than that to see, for leaves lit from above became a screen catching light's complicity from stream top to under canopy, lines rippling across bright pages torn from life, in constant interplay, the light of emotion in which one turn returns reflection, day to day. Thank you.
Through the good graces of the internationally renowned printmaker David Fried, who was a good friend of Larry Levis's, we also have another gift for you, which is this print, which is a portrait of Larry Levis. And David's here.